Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Next story comes to us out of the Washington Post, and it's a really interesting look at how hospitals are having to approach the coronavirus as people come in. And the decisions that they're having to make about DNRs, these do not resuscitate orders. And the story goes to several hospitals and the legal questions they are starting to have about whether to resuscitate people who have coronavirus. So the story starts off, hospitals on the front lines of the pandemic are engaged in a heated private debate over a calculation few have encountered in their lifetimes, how to weigh the save-at-all-costs approach to resuscitating a dying patient against the real danger of exposing doctors and nurses to the contagion of coronavirus. Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago has been discussing a do-not-resuscitate policy for infected patients regardless of the wishes of the patient or their family members, a wrenching decision to prioritize the lives of many over the life of one. One of Northwestern's intensive care medical directors, Richard Wondernick, said hospital administrators would have to ask Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker for help in clarifying state law and whether it allows a policy shift. Officials at George Washington University Hospital in D.C. say they have had similar conversations, but for now will continue to resuscitate COVID-19 patients using modified procedures like putting plastic sheeting over the patient to create a barrier. Because the issue is, of course, is a lack of protective gear for the doctors and nurses that are dealing with these patients. So right now, they're dealing with a problem by severely limiting the number of responders to a contagious patient and cardiac or respiratory arrest. Several large hospital systems are looking at guidelines that would let doctors override the wishes of coronavirus patients or family members on a case-by-case basis due to the risk to doctors and nurses, a shortage of protective equipment, and ethicists and doctors involved are having those conversations now. They would stop short of imposing a do not resuscitate order on every patient, but they are looking at that as a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about terrifying. And I don't want to overstate this because these kinds of debates go on all the time in the medical community. There's a reason why they go on privately, because somebody has to say the awful thing. You know, somebody has to say, look, you know, we're putting 20 people who are trying to resuscitate somebody at risk because of one person who's dying. So does it make sense to do that? Now, it rarely goes in the direction of the horrifying decision being made to say, yeah, we need to let that guy go because we can't put those other people at risk. However, this is how the debate happens. You know, they like I said, they've got to say the terrifying thing. But no decision has been made yet. And they're just, you know, they're talking about putting this in place. But, you know, with something that's that contagious, I mean, you look at the fact that we didn't do that during Ebola. You know what I mean? And for something that was maybe not as contagious, I mean, this disease seems to be much more contagious than that. But Ebola was also devastating to almost everybody who got it, to the point that during the first outbreak, I think the death rate was like 80%. And we're not seeing any, you know, anything anywhere near this with coronavirus. So because we didn't do it then, and there were still doctors who, and nurses who were every day working on patients, you know, who had Ebola. The other important thing to note about that, of course, is that Ebola transmitted through a bodily fluid. So you could stay away from it if you wanted to. This one's airborne. But again, that's why there's a whole bunch of people in a room pulling their hair out and yelling at each other, trying to get straight what's going to happen here. I honestly, you know, I hate to try to crystal ball things like this, but I don't think that they're going to make any kind of grand decision to go, you know what, if somebody's dying of coronavirus, you let them go.
No, but I do see that states are going to be asking for clarity on state law. So if
yes.
they do get into that position, they know what kind of authority they have. That
yeah.
if there is not family there to ask and the person is unconscious and they have to make the decision, that they have the and this is to me, this is a crazy decision to be making, that someone who does not have a DNR that maybe could be resuscitated, but it would take 15 people in the room with protective gear. And if a hospital doesn't have that gear to protect them, that hospital's got to make the decision that I can't even imagine. We don't have protective gear for 15 people, but we do have it for two people. So do we just send two people in to try to revive that person? Well, what if it requires six, but we only have the gear for two? Or we have the gear for 20 people, but we need to save that for the other people that are not dying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What a horrible decision to make. The fact that they're even asking for clarity on state law is terrifying.
Yeah, and it means that, again, they're getting ready for that decision possibly to be made. But, again, I want to just stay as far away from jumping the gun on saying, this is what's going to happen. They're going to let your grandma die because, you know, she's got coronavirus and they don't want to resuscitate her. Where I think they're going to run into trouble, and this may be legally speaking as well as just ethically, is that idea of doing it against the patient's wishes. Letting somebody die who wants to be saved, that's something I don't recall ever seeing before in medical science.
Let me ask this. So I don't know the legalities of, I know you can have a DNR that says do not resuscitate if, you know, and we've talked before about hospital. We've kind of talked before about the opposite, that hospitals will err on the side of reviving you always unless it's clear that you have a DNR, which a lot
sure.
of times, if there's no one with you when you go into cardiac arrest, or if it's not on file with that hospital, or if they can't find it, they're just going to err on the side of reviving you unless it's absolutely clear that you have a DNR. I'm curious to know if it's going to go the opposite direction, and that now you are going to want some kind of documentation saying,
save
resuscitate
me.
Yeah, I do not have a DNR. Resuscitate me at all costs, because you don't like... Use the expensive, you know, prioritize me for your protective gear over somebody else, you know, because I'm dying. The cases are going to be really interesting. And so what the story points out is that Wondernick from Northwestern said, all of the most critically ill patients in the 12 days since they had their first coronavirus case have had steady declines rather than a steady crash. That allowed medical staff to talk with families about the risk to workers and how having to put on protective gear delays a response and decreases the chance of saving someone's life. Well, the tricky situation is that that's putting families in horrible positions then. And
yep.
kind of like what you hope is that there's not any guilt going to those families. Like, hey, you know, you have to make the decision about whether we potentially waste protective gear trying to save your loved one rather than save that for somebody we actually have a better chance of saving. And that is a horrible position to put families in.
Well, sure. And you know who I would love to hear on this are medical professionals. We've heard from so many of you. And I know, by the way, that this is an incredibly busy time for you. But you guys have been great so far over the course of these last couple of weeks at participating in the show and letting us know, you know, again, whether you're a home health nurse or whether you're a doctor who works in a hospital in an ER, you guys have let us know very well what you're dealing with on this from day to day. So when it comes down to those kinds of ethical questions, is it just a matter of you looking at this and saying, well, I got into this to save people, you know, forgive the super chicken reference, but I knew the job was dangerous when I took it? Or do you say, look, it's not just me. It's not just a choice of my life. It's also my kids and everybody I come in contact with, in addition to this coronavirus patient that I'm trying to save.
Yeah, and what power do families and patients have in that situation? And if we have anybody listening who knows a little bit more about this than we do, and it's possible that because we've never really been in this position before, we don't really know. We don't really know what power families have or where the law sits here. you know, and because the ultimate question is going to become, if doctors go to the family and propose this question of, hey, we don't have enough protective gear maybe to send a team of 15 people in to help your loved one, can families insist, hey, my loved one doesn't have a DNR, and yes, I want you to use your 15 sets of gear to go save my loved one. Can families insist? And if they do, can hospitals override the family's wishes? That's ultimately going to be the big legal question.
Yeah, and it's funny because we got a text in a little while ago that mentioned euthanasia and said, shame on America. Well, first of all, nobody's doing this. So save the shame until the decision is made. But it isn't really technically euthanasia either. Euthanasia is actively doing something that causes somebody's death. This is just passively standing by and letting somebody go. It's a fine distinction, I understand, but it is a distinction. What I wonder, though, is because of that text, what does the law say about that? Could you legally make a case that euthanasia laws, which have been enacted just about everywhere, would cover something like this and would prevent a doctor from saying, no, I'm going to let that person go, even though they would, under normal circumstances, want me to step in and try and save them?
And is this then a conversation that you are going to start to have with your family then? It's always interesting how people don't, don't have DNRs or don't, you know, have paperwork that lays out what kind of life-saving measures they would want. I'm curious to know if it's going to prompt some of us to have conversations with your loved ones, particularly if you have members of your family that are maybe more at risk. Is that going to prompt you to have some of those conversations? We'd love to hear from doctors or from anybody listening in the medical profession.
Yeah, and by the way, that also goes into that category you were talking about earlier of things that we should have done anyway. If you haven't talked to your family about things like DNRs and living wills and all of that, why not? You know, it shouldn't have taken this to have those conversations. That's information everybody needs to be aware of.
But again, we're kind of going the opposite direction. If you have a DNR, that's easy. That's easy in this situation. They know they can do it. They know they can just skip it and just not resuscitate you. I wonder if it's going to make people come up with paperwork that says, I want to be revived. You need to prioritize me for this PPE.
Yeah, save me at all costs.
Yeah, we'll get to your calls and your texts coming up 22980, or you can call us at 576-7798. Talk about this story out of the Washington Post. So I'm sure you've heard that hospitals have a shortage of that protective gear that they need to keep them from catching coronavirus if they were to have a patient that comes in with it. And so with that, hospitals are looking to their governors for advice on what they would do in a situation if they could override a patient's orders when it comes to do not resuscitate, or let a family make that decision if it requires 15 people in a room to bring someone back to life or to get someone out of cardiac arrest, but they don't have enough gear for 15 people, or they do, but that really, really makes them run low. Hospitals are wondering, can they ignore patients' wishes in order to make sure they have enough protective gear for people who are in better shape? We've got several callers on the line. Let's go first to Kansas City and bring in Mary Pat. Hi, Mary Pat.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Doing great. So tell us a little bit about it. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, it's a very dismal thought for sure, but I believe that they're looking at how to save the many versus saving the one kind of theory. And PPE is a very real issue. I think I've discussed that with you all before. It's very frightening. But I am stunned by the fact that they have to make that decision in our United States of America. But it's a real issue. I mean, we don't even have enough ventilators. So if you resuscitated a person and didn't have a ventilator to put them on, it would all be for naught, and you would really be prolonging issues. That's one thing I think of. The other thing I think of is that if an ethics committee or the governor, I guess, would decide that this is okay, they would not be asking families. They would be telling families, this is the situation. We are not going to resuscitate your loved one.
Yeah, this is what needs to happen, yeah.
Right. And I do know that at the University of Missouri, I had need to do a research project once, and I called the consultation service for medical ethics there, where they actually do make decisions about do not resuscitate. And I'd be glad to give someone that number later. It might be interesting to talk to someone that's like their livelihood, that they maintain those kind of ethics.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, we'll put you on hold with Jason. You can give him that number off the air, and we'll see if we can get in touch with him. But are you with me, though, that, I mean, like I just said a little while ago, I can't remember a time when, as you said, we had to make those decisions of the needs of the many versus the needs of the few. That ever entered into medicine before. It was always, if there's a guy who's in trouble, guy in the generic, who's in trouble, you save him. You do everything you can.
In a hospital, yes. I would think where that probably would be a situation more would be in a disaster situation where somebody had to decide, well, this person is so critical that we can't do anything right now, but this person we can help. That's the only place I would even venture to say that kind of a decision-making process is.
Yeah, like battlefield medicine.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think back to more or less the beginning of my career when we were just, AIDS was just coming into the forefront. And I think how sad those people would be in a room, and you might walk in and find your patient with 2 days worth of trays in there because people were avoiding them. I just hope that isn't happening with this coronavirus, but the lack of PPE is probably making this very, very difficult for people to not be afraid, even medical people.
You got it. Mary Pat, thank you. I appreciate the... Yeah, Jason, if you could put Mary Pat on hold. She's got a phone number for you of the medical ethics folks, and we're going to see if we can get in touch with them for a future show, because these are questions that are going to remain relevant as long as we're in the middle of all of this.
We'll go back to the phones then.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the phones. We've got another Mary, this one in Oak Grove, who's up next to us. Hey, Mary, how you doing?
Hi. I want people to realize that every hospital has a risk management department, and they are good to talk to when you're feeling stuck. My husband he had DNR, he had signed definite things he did not want, and at the last minute, a doctor I'd never seen before whizzed in and claimed he changed his mind and tried to put us through a whole lot of expensive stuff 4 days before he died anyway. And I didn't know what to do. I am a nurse, but I wasn't up on it. I thought the DNR and all of our wishes would be honored.
So did you have the opportunity to talk to those ethics folks at the hospital?
Yeah, I had to get an attorney to tell me.
Oh, okay. And he did it. Yeah.
No, he just told me what to say. He said, you asked for risk management. And he said, you be very firm. And he said, you call me back if they don't change their tune. But some hospitals and some physicians have been very determined to do expensive things that won't help.
Yep. All right. Well, Mary, good information. Thank you very much. So, yeah, risk management. They are your friend. We appreciate the telephone call.
Yeah, it'll be interesting just to see what advice hospitals end up getting from their governors, because there's no area of state law that makes it clear, or federal law, or wherever it happens to go. Under what circumstances can a hospital ignore the explicit wishes of a patient? The problem, again, is that it's easy if you have a DNR, then we know what you're going to do. But most of us don't carry around paperwork saying, here's how long I want to be kept alive. Here's exactly a lot of people have that paperwork, but you don't keep that with you all the time.
Right. We're used to arguing this the other way around, where the hospital wants to do something to save your life. And you say, nah, you know what? I'd really rather not go through that. And they try to talk you into it. This is the exact flip of that, where they're saying, we have other people we need to protect here. And since we don't have all of the answers that we don't have about communicability and all of the other things that, you know, we know essentially how to keep ourselves safe from this, but as Mary Pat pointed out, we don't really have the equipment to be able to do it on a mass scale. These are questions now that are coming up that we haven't had to deal with, at least not in a very long time.
I got to read you this quote on the Washington Post story. Bruno Petsenax, who is the chief medical officer at George Washington University Hospital, said, "They have had a lot of discussion about how and whether to resuscitate COVID-19 patients who are coding." Here's his quote. "From a safety perspective, you can make the argument that the safest thing to do is nothing." And he said, you know, they've made the decision not to go in that direction. But if you are arguing what is the safest thing is to save your gear and expose the fewest number of people possible.
And that goes right to what we were just talking about. He recognizes that there is a logic to it, but they still haven't made the decision to go in that direction because they don't want to. It's hard. I mean, this is why most of us aren't doctors. You know, it's hard to do that. It's hard to make a decision that you know is going to lead to somebody dying.
And again,
the problem here
is that you need really quick. We're in such an urgent time frame here. You know, that's all these emergency orders and stuff that have come down. The problem is that these are the kinds of decisions and the kind of guidelines that take a while for experts to get together and come up with guidelines on and talk to each other. And the problem is that this all happened so fast. And this was something that nobody expected, that we would suddenly have a shortage of this kind of hospital gear, that, you know, ethicists are having to get together and come up with some guidance pretty quickly on how to handle this.
Yeah, and we'll just have to watch them all do it. But again, don't be concerned so much about the argument. The argument has to happen. Be concerned about the results of it when they come out.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.